Welcome back, everyone, to another edition of the Prove Me Wrong podcast. Once again, as always, I am your host, Pete Lieb. I'm glad you're here joining me tonight. I have a great show tonight, as always. It's a Monsters of Rock edition, if you will. My guest tonight is Mr. Greg Renoff, and we are going to talk about his book, Van Halen Rising, How a Southern California Backyard Party Band Saved Heavy Metal. Anyone who knows me or has listened to the show in past episodes already knows how much music means to me personally, so I'm extremely excited to talk about and discuss one of my favorite bands and musical influencers. We've actually already even had an episode where a buddy of mine and I talked about our favorite Van Halen album. Greg was born in the Bronx, New York, grew up in New Jersey. He earned his PhD in American History from Brandeis University and is the author of, again, Van Halen Rising, How a Southern California Backyard Party Band Saved Heavy Metal, and Ted Templeman, A Platinum Producer's Life in Music. His writing has appeared in Guitar World, LA Weekly, and Vulture, and he and his work have also been profiled in Spin, Salon, Maxim, Rolling Stone, and many more. He currently resides in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and enjoys connecting with his readers through the VanHalenRising.com website, and you can also find him on Twitter.com/Greg Renoff. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and say, welcome, Greg, to the Prove Me Wrong podcast.
Hey, Pete, thanks for having me on. It's been a long time coming, and I'm glad to do it.
Absolutely. First, right off the bat, the time frame of your book is incredibly interesting to me, because most of what you see with regards to those type of biography books are, this is what's happened to the band once they became famous, the debauchery, the drunken nights, this, that, sure, and the other thing. Your book focuses a little bit differently from the point of formation till when they became famous. Right. So if you could, start me off with some of the background and why you decided to write a book about that time frame and what was the inspiration for you?
So I would say that the inspiration for me is, like you, fandom of Van Halen. I think that was something that was a driving force of doing this book. It was not the most conventional book idea I could have come with for my academic career at the time. That's a different issue. But I was somebody who went to graduate school, became a historian. You know, I'd gone to tons of shows as a kid. I'd seen Iron Maiden, Van Halen, you know, Motley Crue. We go through the whole list of '80s bands you would expect. Black Crowes, all these bands I'd seen. And you know, I always had a thing for Van Halen. And as a historian, what I was always struck by was that you'd pick up books or magazines, and obviously what I would call the fame years were pretty well documented. Right. There'd been a number of good books, you know, like Ian Christie's Everybody Wants Some book kind of covered the whole, whenever that book came out about 15 years ago, kind of covered the whole timeline of Van Halen from Roth break up to Hagar to the coming of Gary Cherone, all these different things. You know, and so when I was looking at those books and looking at Wikipedia, and I always, you know, I always felt that the beginnings of the band kind of weren't really clearly laid out. And I think that is just was a product of the fact that they were, you know, it was kind of obscure. I mean, you know, right, the only things you had to go on was basically interviews with the band members who would talk about something, a Circus magazine or a Rolling Stone, about backyard parties or about what t-shirt contests or about Gene Simmons and these things. And so I just started doing a bit of research, and it's just snowballed into a book. And so I didn't really have a big master plan about doing a Van Halen book. It sort of turned into that. And then once I really decided I was going to focus on the early years, it was pretty evident to me, actually, early on in doing the book research, that there was going to be so much material.
Okay.
And so many key events that it to go beyond 1978, I kind of realized was going to be diluted, because I think, you know, you can pick up that story in any number of other books, and for that segment of their career, that whatever you want to call it, that early stages of Van Halen's existence, their goal was to get a record deal,
right,
and to become, you know, for, you know, to get signed, get a record deal, make a record, and then obviously their dream was to be a successful big band, like any band that would go on the road. With a Warner Brothers record contract, you're hoping for bigger and better things, that you're going to become a lasting act that's going to make records. So that was sort of the idea of having them sort of launch themselves. That was the way that, you know, I saw the book narrative being put together. And, you know, kind of in retrospect, you look at things like The Social Network or Straight Outta Compton and movies like this. That's sort of the, you know, the backstory of the band being the story. And so, you know, for me, when I was working on this, I just kept thinking to myself, I have learned so much about Van Halen, and I feel like I understand so much more of what makes the band tick, meaning the personalities in the band. And again, this was not from anyone who's picked up the book should know. I didn't directly interview David Lee Roth. I didn't directly interview Eddie Van Halen. I read every interview I could get my hands on by him. I read also these clippings, these magazine articles, but also, you know, they were on the road in 78 and they would end up in, you know, Evansville, Indiana, and they with the local newspaper were like, new band Van Halen. Those guys would talk to the Evansville newspaper and they had all these things to say about how they formed and all this stuff. You know, so it was really from just gathering interviews with people who grew up with those guys, saw them in backyard parties, promoters who hired them to play at venues, but also teenagers who just basically hired them to play in backyards, and along with men and women, everyone from Jackie Foxx of the Runaways to Mark Kendall of Great White, people who went on to some level of fame later, but at the time kind of observed Van Halen themselves. And then I got the great perspective of them going, oh, they actually made it in the business as well. And you kind of look back and go, Here's what I saw. And so for me, that, you know, that whole sense of getting a really good grip on the personalities and what made the band make it, you know, why this band made it, and so many other bands who have talent and had ability didn't make it. I thought, you know, all that stuff was kind of crystallized in doing this research on their early days. And so that was the, you know, that was kind of the idea of it. And then I guess I mentioned just sort of the end being, boom, 1978, they've made it, trying to do the 78 tour, and then they're off.
Right.
Off to the rest of their career. Because people know the rest of the story to some degree. You know, they knew that story.
And that's probably why there were so many books, because that there was a plethora of information from that point. I mean, I assumed it must have been much more difficult for you to obtain the information. You kind of went through how you got some of it. That was actually one of my questions, was how hard was it to get all that early day information for the book?
Yeah, so it was difficult. You know, like I have my kids in preschool, and their teacher does this thing where he goes, pat yourself on the back.
Yeah,
this
right?
Like gag he does over Zoom. So I'm like, I'll do that, pat myself on the back as a joke. You know, it was difficult because obviously as a band that was not famous, they were not covered in the press. I mean, occasionally might be a clipping or something in one of the Pasadena newspapers. There might be an ad or two that was in the newspapers, but there was no media coverage until probably 77 when they started showing up on the Sunset Strip, and then,
right.
And then 78. So what it was almost entirely based upon oral interviews. And so I kind of got a foothold there with a couple of people from Pasadena. And I made a point every time I talked to somebody from Pasadena or from Arcadia, you know, whether they were someone who grew up with Mark Stone, the bass player from Arcadia, Mike Anthony's from Arcadia, Mike Anthony from Arcadia, or you grew up with Mark Stone or any of the guys that were in the band, you know, who else should I talk to? And they would pass me along. Typically, you know, they'd be like, oh, you should talk to this guy. He, you know, he fixed Eddie's guitars. You talk to this guy. He bought it, you know, like really, he bought a car from Dave. You know, he has a really weird story. And, you know, some of those turned out to be dead end, so to speak. And, you know, but a lot of them weren't. And it was just a matter of accumulating information through these oral interviews and then building out the story from there. And, you know, building trust. That was the other thing I always talk about. Is it going to do a book like this? You know, it's important, I think, to some extent, that people understand that, you know, at least I thought it was, that I was a fan, and I was not looking to do some sort of salacious book on the band. It was meant to be a musical, their musical rise, rather than sort of like, oh, I'm going to dig up this dirt on these guys, which was never the intention of the book. And so I think once people kind of understood, because they feel, you know, some of these people were, you know, they may not see the guys in the band anymore, but they were friends. They were their close friends in high school. They like hung out with them. Like, you know, it's like, oh, these were our guys. They hung out with them. And so, you know, kind of to build that trust with those people who I'm very grateful to them. They spoke to me that, you know, they understood it was meant to be it was really meant to be, you know, kind of a tribute to their hard work in so many ways more than anything else.
Well, you know, when I was growing up and you know, I grew up in the early 80s, mid 80s, my first, and I mentioned before, we've already had a previous episode in the podcast where a buddy of mine were talking about our early influences and the favorite albums that we had from Van Halen. And for me, it wasn't necessarily because I thought the album was the best album, but it was the most emotionally tying to me because I was 11 years old and 1984 came out.
Sure.
And so that was really my introduction, was 1984. And at that point, when in my high school, friendships were made by the Sammy Dave question. You know,
right.
Honestly, if somebody said you would meet somebody and they would almost be like, Sammy or Dave, and you knew what kind of person they were by who they would pick. If they said Dave, you knew
it's
they were
interesting.
They had a little bit
it's
more
interesting,
fun.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
So again, that's what you know. It was always that way with me. And but just to go back to Eddie and Alex, they were the genesis of the band, obviously. And what was some of their background? I mean, I had heard that originally, or that their instruments were reversed. Eddie was playing the drums originally, and Alex was playing the guitar. And then they kind of realized that both had better aptitude for the other. How did they grow up? They had a musical family, I know, but what kind of information can you give us on that?
Sure. They arrived in the United States in 1962 from Holland. Their father was a jazz musician of some, you know, of some renown in Holland. Hmm. He was one of these, he was a clarinetist and a sax player, and he was somebody who would have played with orchestras and been on TV and the radio in Holland. And the family moved to the United States from Holland. Supposedly, again, the family lore, if you hear Eddie and Alex talk about this, that the, there were, I believe their mother had relatives living in Southern California, talked about how wonderful Southern California was and they should move there. And so the family left Holland and came, and Eddie and Alex have talked about how they basically came with a little bit of money and they moved their piano to the States. And what it turned out to be for their dad, Jan, was that opportunities were not really abundant. It was the musical scene in Southern California was different than it was in Holland. He probably had a lot of connections from his years in orchestras and could get gigs, whereas in the United States, he didn't speak the language. And, you know, big band jazz wasn't particularly, as you can imagine, like big in 1962, 63 in Los Angeles. And so there was definitely a need for their father to do things like janitorial work, you know, work in hospitals, work in a machine shop and do these things that, you know, he probably hadn't ever done in Holland, or I presume he hadn't done in Holland. So there was definitely, you know, it was definitely a very blue collar existence for the family. And the brothers were seen by their parents as buddy musicians. And that was the idea that they were going to take up the musical family tradition. And famously, they start off taking piano lessons. They actually take it from a Russian piano teacher who was quite, you know, quite well trained. He was trained in one of the academies, the Academy in St. Petersburg, basically the Imperial Academy of Music, as I recall correctly, in St. Petersburg. And, you know, at some point the brothers discover rock and roll in the early 60s, like 64, 65, they start hearing the Beatles, they start hearing these different British invasion groups, and they start to play guitar and they start to play drums, and there's that famous switch. But the brothers took piano lessons probably till like 1966 or 67, so there were some years of doing that. But that was the moment there where they, you know, sort of left piano behind and took up rock and roll. And from everything I learned in doing the book is that the family was, even if they were not thrilled about their decision to take up different instruments, were definitely very supportive of the brothers doing music. It was sort of like, that was the family, you know, the family path, different families. Some people, you know, come from a family of doctors and lawyers. They came from a family of musicians, and that was the thing they were going to do.
And so originally when they started playing together, Eddie was singing originally, right?
Correct.
And then he kind of made the decision that I wasn't a good enough singer. I'm not going to be able to focus on the guitar. Or what caused him to say, okay, let's get a singer in here?
Yeah. So, Eddie and Alex started playing together probably around 19. I mean, basically I say playing together, meaning like they started to play like gigs or something, like the basement of a church or something like that. They'd play, middle school assemblies, these types of things that, you know, and Eddie came the default singer. They had a bass player named Mark Stone, and Alex played drums, and they were trios. They were first called Genesis and then called Mammoth. And, by 1973 or so, they'd start to make a name for themselves on the backyard party circuit. They got bigger after Roth joined. But from what the legend and the truth will tell you is that it was two things. It was basically Alex realized, and Eddie kind of realized, that Eddie was not really a singer. He was just a guy who sort of like filled in the vocals. And it was something that was not sustainable going forward. He was not going to be able to pull that off. And they were also renting the PA system from Dave, as every Van Halen fan worth their salt knows, that Roth had a PA system from his own group. And eventually Alex, you know, and the brothers sort of realized it would be better to let Dave join the band. But as I discussed in Van Halen Rising, Dave really wanted to join Van Halen and the brothers had some doubts about his singing ability, and they thought, you know, he was just the lack of sync between right. his musical taste and theirs. But, you know, it was cheaper to get Dave in the band, so that sort of thing, which was kind of what they say.
I was actually going to ask you that. Was he really, from what you've heard, was he really as quote unquote tone deaf as they initially thought he was? I know his vocals weren't as good. His strength was not vocals. I mean, I honestly do think, in my personal opinion, David Lee Roth is the greatest frontman of all time. I mean, I really feel that.
Sure.
But it wasn't because of his singing. I mean, it was the way that he, you know, somehow or another, David Roth could be the sexiest man alive and the biggest goofball alive,
right.
alternately within a minute of each other. That's a real skill. I mean, there's something to that, because they absolutely lost that. When Sammy came in, he was a league ahead in terms of singing, but they lost that front man that, right. that they had with Dave. Were those reservations real when they said, I don't know that this guy can sing?
Yeah, I mean, they were. I think, you know, the most of the perspective I would say beyond the guys in the band I got from the guys who were around Mammoth at the time. And there was, you know, from what I heard from the friends who were basically the regulars and the guys who, you know, grew up with the brothers, you know, there was really like a shock that like, they're like, are you seriously this guy sing for your group? You know, I remember one guy told me, he's like, you know, we were walking around going, Eddie and Alex, just why did they ruin their group? You know, I'm like, and it was just part of it was sort of territorial. I mean, they had like, people said like, you know, Mammoth, it was our group and it was our thing, and they changed it by letting Dave in, you know. But, you know, Roth was, you know, he was definitely different. I mean, that's the thing. He's like, you know, somebody gave a great example to me when I was doing Van Halen Rising, was talking about basically like, you know, everybody else is like super self-conscious at that time. You're like 19, 18, you're like, where, you know, what yeah. you wear and these types of things. And like, you know, Roth would show up and he's like these crazy outfits for backyard parties. Like those guys are in jeans and t-shirts, and Dave shows up in like an open neck shirt, you know, like a silk shirt, and like basically like David Bowie shoes, like women's shoes, you know, with the time, we're like, you know. And so the other guys were like, well, man, we're playing at Susie Thompson's backyard partner patio. Dude, what are you doing? Like, what, this is, you know, what the hell is wrong with you? Like, you know, but to Dave, it was all about the show and the showmanship. And so I think part of it was like a hazing thing. You know, I don't think if you listen to the bootlegs, I mean, obviously Roth is like, you know, he wasn't terrible, but he also was not Ian Gillan. He wasn't, right. you know, he wasn't some sort of like, and there were guys around like that on the scene, like the local scene, and you go to clubs and you hear guys who had really like kind of like classic 70s rock voices. He didn't have that. So that's the other thing. You know, so when he tried to sing some of these things, it was kind of a train wreck in some ways, but again, it didn't matter because
what you just said there, I mean, right up until that point, most of the frontmen just kind of stood there and played the guitar. Maybe they had they would have suits and ties and they'd kind of do a little shimmy with their shoulders. And to me, maybe Robert Plant before that a little bit did some of that, but David, it all, he took it to a different level. And I agree with you that he just didn't seem to care. And it worked. I mean, and he just gave off the sex appeal. He gave off this, I don't give a shit, I'm jumping and you know, from 8 foot off the risers and I'm doing karate kicks, and it just worked. And you know, you can say,
I had one woman tell me, you'll appreciate this, right? One woman yeah. tell me, one of the first people I interviewed, she remembered seeing Van Halen like in like 1975 at some Masonic temple or something like that. Like and she said she remembered the, you know, she was like, what the hell's with this guy? Who the hell does this guy think he is? Yeah. He's like singing his, you know, basically shaking his chest around and swinging yeah. his hair around. And it was, you know, basically like a little $2, three bands, that type of thing. Nobody's yeah. famous. And she said she distinctly remembered being like, this guy thinks he's God's gift to women. And she basically said to me, like, and 10 years later, he was God's gift to women. You know, like, anyway, she was like, that was, she was actually yeah. like offended by that. She was like, I was offended. And then she's like, realized like, holy crap.
He really is. He did. Every man, every boy in my school in the early 90s or the early 80s wanted to be David Lee Roth. We yeah. all did. Every one of us. Something was working. That self-confidence, you know, it just radiated off of him. I mean, from all you've heard, was that a persona? I mean, was that a put-on, or is that really who he was? You know, that frantic, spastic. If you hear him talking in interviews now, I don't know you ever get a real answer from him. Everything is right. in a circular mode, and it's usually funny as hell, but it doesn't. You can't really tell if it makes sense. You're just laughing at it. Is he that way from those who know him?
I mean, you know, that's the thing. It's like, you know, from what I was, you know, from what I was told from talking to people, you know, Dave's persona in public pretty much was like that. I remember, you know, you'd see Dave, like, you'd see Dave cutting class with his shirt unbuttoned. This is like sophomore year in high school, like headed out to the parking lot to smoke a joint with somebody or something. I mean, it seems like that was the thing. You know, I think we all probably could imagine, like, anybody, everyone has their moments of self-doubt in the private where you're thinking, you know, whatever. I'm just, you know, I have to think, I don't know, but I have, this is my personal speculation that, you know, when they didn't get the record deal with Gene Simmons and Bill O'Coin says in front of all the guys, you know, basically the big problem with the group is you, Dave. I don't really like your singing. I don't think you're any good. I mean, it has to be, had to be crushing inside anybody. How could you not be crushing? So, you know, but he seemed to be able to sort of keep up that, that positive, like almost like a coach, like a positive outlook on things that kept those guys going. But, you know, I mean, I had, had one of his friends tell me very early on, one of the early people I talked to, that he went around the table in middle school. He said, I remember this clear as day. Everyone wanted to be an astronaut, you know, or whatever. Like, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? And Dave was like, I want to be a rock star. And they laughed. They were like, you know, like, you idiot. Basically, you're not going to be a rock star. You know, it was like seventh grade. Surprise.
Right. He definitely,
you didn't become an astronaut, but I became a rock star. You know, it's like incredible, right? It's unbelievable.
Yeah, no doubt. How long was it before Michael Anthony joined the band? You know, he was the last one to come in.
Right.
Yes? How long was it before he joined?
Sure. He joined in something like June 1974. So the last gigs with Mark Stone were probably in, like, you know, a few weeks before that. And Mark was asked to leave by the other guys in the group, which is kind of a hard story to tell. You know, he just was one of these guys who, you know, was basically right there, and it just didn't work out. Mm-hmm. And Mike was brought into the group, but Mark was with them from probably like 1970 until 74. So three and a half, four years. And then Mike came in that summer in 74. And then Mike, then they were the 4-piece original lineup of Van Halen going forward.
It's so amazing to me. And it's interesting that, and you hear it a lot, that bands in that time, they were making it by playing high school dances, backyard play. Right. You know, I'm 40 something guy. I'm in a band as well. We play on the weekends at bars, but you can't even imagine playing at a gymnasium any longer, playing a high school dance, playing a backyard. It's such a different.
Right. There aren't gigs like that anymore. High school's not going to hire some band to play at a prom.
Yeah. Just a local band to come out and play the prom. Now it's all DJs.
Right.
So, I mean, how did they get noticed and well-known playing in the backyard of people's houses?
Well, you know, what made them stand out, first of all, would be, I would say, the musical talent of the brothers. When I talked to people, pretty much everybody had that moment, that Eddie Van Halen, Alex Van Halen moment. And Alex has got to get short shrift sometimes, only because it's like his brother is, like, you know, in the stratosphere of rock guitarists, and there's this guy who's this amazing drummer, but, you know, it's like the one brother is seen as, like, the, you know, in the pantheon of the all time greats for guitar. So it was always Eddie and Alex. They were so amazing together, and Eddie and all this. And so, you know, they got a reputation as being these guys who could play full sides of records and were so super talented. But what really built their notoriety was really these backyard parties. I mean, that was what it was. You know, they were omnipresent. And again, you know, you read the book, the sort of subtext to it, which I tried to weave throughout there, and I put it overtly too, but, you know, kind of gets lost, is that, you know, sometimes they do a party and the party get broken up at 8 o'clock at night, or they do a party and 12 people would be there because whatever, the person didn't give out enough flyers and they would drink the beer and they'd go home. But there were these parties that happened on occasion where the sort of the stars aligned, the flyers went out, it was the right weekend, tons of people, everybody showed up, everyone got there, and there was 500, 1,000, 1,500 kids in some of these backyards. And so there was 3 or 4 of those that happened, which are legendary in Pasadena. I've actually done the tour myself and driven around and seen the homes, and, you know, some of the houses are still there. I think at least three of the houses I'm thinking of are still there. And, you know, they became bigger than life because the helicopter would come, the police would come, and everyone would be talking about it. And especially understand that these parties, in some cases, the flyers were, you know, were beyond Pasadena. Were so, you know, I remember one family in particular said that, just, you know, one of the sisters said it was just, it was two siblings and a brother. We were just, party animals. They used to call it party animals, but we were just so into parties. And so we just went and we wanted to print even more flyers. Like they'd like double the number of flyers. And we went to the Valley and gave them out at high schools and and people showed up and, Van Halen got a reputation that way, and to be honest with you, then they played on the Sunset Strip. That's a whole different story, but that was 1974. Those playing Gazzari's was kind of like it was big for Van Halen to make it on the Sunset Strip, but it wasn't as if like you were in Gazzari's and like you're going to be like rubbing elbows with Led Zeppelin or something. It was kind of seen as like kind of a place where like cover bands play that aren't going anywhere. So it wasn't as if like making the strip at first was like some sort of, like Van Halen's arrived and everybody knew about it. It was just like a kind of a step forward for them. But they always had that ability in Pasadena, Arcadia, that part of the Los Angeles to pull lots of people. And, their reputation got bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's like, someone like I mentioned, Mark Kendall, a Great White, who grew up in, I think Downey, which is another, one other suburb of LA. And he like had heard about them and kind of made his way there to see them. He didn't go to high school with those guys. He, was younger than them, but already they didn't have a record deal. But it was like, oh, this guitarist, you got to go see this guitarist, Van Halen. You got to go see this band. They're really good. So, it was just word of mouth and just being, they basically made their own breaks by doing this sort of like unconventional hard backyard party thing before they started doing the circuit of nightclubs and bars and biker bars in LA.
And just going back real quick to your statement about the brothers and their musical ability. And, the most amazing thing to me about these two, that they had completely distinct sounds. When you hear the solo, it beat it. You knew that was Eddie Van Halen. Right. You just knew it. And Alex has this force on the drums. He has almost like a John Bonham, just big, heavy, booming on the drums. And it's him. And that alone is what most musicians are striving for. Most musicians are striving to be, because a guitar sounds like a guitar in most people's hands. It's not like a voice that sounds different.
Correct.
Each instrument's different.
Sure.
But they both found a way to set themselves apart. And I will say, with regards to Michael Anthony, I think that he is the unsung hero of the band. I don't think that Van Halen sound would be Van Halen sound without Michael Anthony doing those high harmonies up at the top.
Right.
That's what made that sound that most other bands couldn't duplicate because they couldn't hit where he was at.
Right. And that's an interesting point that you bring up. I mean, I think the thing is that, as I mentioned, Mark Stone, and the bass player, I mean, that was one of the things that probably was one of the motivating factors to making the change was that Mike sang with his own group, had a really good voice. For most of the songs that they were trying to do, the songs that they needed to do top 40 material. So they were starting to play nightclubs. They just started to play Gazzari's. Having the ability to have those harmonies and all that stuff that was on the radio, all that 70s stuff, Motown stuff, whatever they were doing, 60s stuff, having a guy who could fill in those background vocals, it was really important. Eddie was, always an adequate singer and could do the backgrounds okay, but he was never a guy whose voice was distinctive or was going to kind of stand out. He just kind of filled in. And, they were smart enough to kind of, latch on to a guy who played bass really well, was a good guy, showed up, did his stuff, wasn't problematic in any way, and was, as you mentioned, like a super talented vocalist. Yeah, very, very important in terms of their ability to build their own sound. Like
for
you mentioned,
sure.
Eddie and Alex having distinctive sound. Dave, that's, as we all know, that's what makes a group. Black Sabbath was to make Black Sabbath raise. Bill Ward, Geezer Butler, Tony Iommi, and Ozzy all had their own individual sound. You can pick them out, and they all like blend together and makes Black Sabbath. That's what made Van Halen so special.
Absolutely, but then everybody chased at least Eddie's sound. The entire decade of the 80s was a bunch of guys trying to chase that Eddie Van Halen sound until the 90s came, and they said, quit doing that. Let's not even play solos. So it's amazing how he was a titanic shift in the way that music was played, the way that music was, and they just kept pushing it and pushing it. Quite honestly, I think the showmanship of these metal bands came from that ridiculousness from Dave in the front.
Big time.
And every one of these guys who was finger-picking 300 notes per second all came from Eddie. So, Warrant and Skid Row and all these bands that came up in the 80s are all kissing the boots of Van Halen when it comes down to it. So you had mentioned earlier that there was definitely a difference between Dave's musical style and Eddie's musical style. And you definitely saw that in some of the choices that they made in those early albums. Dave was always kind of pushing, it seemed like the cover album. He wanted to put all these cover songs in there and it really rubbed Eddie raw. Was that something that was really a big source of pain between the two of them, even in the beginning?
You know, I don't think it was, I think probably in the beginning, it was probably, I think the very, very beginning, I mean, like when Dave first joined, Dave talks about it in his book. And I suspect, yes, that was a real difficult sort of ability to sort of mesh at first, where Dave was suggesting things like Billy Preston will look around in circles, yeah, which you can be sure the brothers were like, I don't play this song. But it was a hit, right? And it was a hit, and they played it. They covered it. They played it where the brothers wanted to do Symptom of the Universe or something like that, something like Sabbath stuff. When you can just imagine how that doesn't easily mesh, you know. But I think once Roth particularly impressed upon the other guys that if they want to play nightclubs, and they should play nightclubs, that they have to learn Top 40, mm-hmm, it kind of became a way for Dave's input to start to put its impression upon the group. I think one of the things that's most notable about Van Halen's first record is how short and compact the songs are as compared to other heavy metal hard rock groups. They are very pop constructed. And I'm not saying something that's some sort of like revelation, but that I think came from the fact that a lot of the stuff those guys did in nightclubs, they had to play these pop hits, Elton John, Steely Dan, whatever it was at the time that was on the charts, they played it. And I think that helps us understand how that coming together happened. You know, I don't think Dave ever convinced those guys that they should do funk music. I mean, I'm sure he would have, like, you know, I'm sure that's what he would have wanted to do a lot of, you know, and they did some Gazaris and some stuff, but it was never going to be like a main thread through the band sound. There may be bits and pieces we could hear there, but you know, that all that Motown stuff, mm-hmm, gets filtered through maybe in something like Jamie's Crying eventually with Roth's lyrics and things like that. But you know, that's that initial, I think, where Roth talks about it was terrible. Our first gigs were terrible. They tried to make me sing the stuff I couldn't sing. I mean, you know, it just, we weren't really connecting. That eventually, I think, kind of worked itself out once they started to play nightclubs rather than backyards. Because then the brothers, you know, you couldn't play Dazed and Confused in a nightclub. You know, you can't play a 19-minute jam. People are going to be pissed because they want to dance, and you can't really dance to Dazed and Confused.
Well, I mean, from everything I've heard, I thought Dave's instincts were always very good. You know, even from to say, hey, the name should be Van Halen, should be your name. It's an awesome name. It's a powerful name. His instincts were very good in that. And to me, without him, Alex and Eddie had every opportunity to become like Rush. And I'm not saying that Rush is bad, but you just can't listen to Rush for that long. No offense to Geddy Lee out there. You just can't. You can appreciate the artistry of what they're doing. You can appreciate how difficult everything they're playing is. Alex Lifeson's just tearing it up on the guitar. You can appreciate it.
Right.
But eventually you tire of it. And Eddie and Alex, I think, would have gone that way. And Dave kept pulling them back. Here, hey, wait a minute. Hey, look, this is what you want. You want to play for the chicks. You want the chicks to get excited about what you're doing. You can show them that you're talented still. And I think that once, by the time they broke up, they realized the formula was right. And then so when Sammy can come in and they can kind of just pick up on it and keep going. But I think if he hadn't been there right off the bat and they had just been left to their own devices, it could have been a whole different band.
Yeah. I mean, I think, like, I always think, like, maybe, you know, Eddie and Alex, they get they come with a bass player, different bass player, Mike, or they go with Mike and they become like, you know, they do like a Jeff Beck type thing, like, you know, like instrumental fusion-y stuff. You know, again, there's no singer. I mean, they probably would have excelled at that. I mean, they would have been good at that.
They'll get a ton of accolades, but they will not be having a podcast from me tonight.
Sure. Like Ted Templeman talked about, even, like, you know, he was like mulling over Van Halen. He's like, well, even if the whole group doesn't work, the guitar player, he's good enough to be a solo artist, or he's good enough to be a studio. Like, he's like super talented. Like, he could be in the, you know, he could be the guy you bring into like the play. He did on Beat It. He did for Nicolette Larson. He was, there was, like, obviously the musicianship was there, but yes, like you're saying, you know, that was always my, you know, we would never be able to know. It's impossible to know, but that was always my basic conclusion after thinking about it quite a bit, is that, like, you know, without Dave, it wouldn't have turned out the same. Obviously not. I mean, obviously not. And they probably would, you know, it wouldn't have, you know, it,
Sometimes you just need that pull. You need that pull to pull you out of your own head and out of your own self, and to kind of snap you into, hey, let's pull you a little bit back to center. And I think that Dave did that for them and pulled them back to center. But who knows?
It's like imagining the Stones without Jagger. I mean, yeah. Could those guys probably have made it with a different singer? Yeah, probably. Maybe they would have been as big as the Animals or something like that. They would have been big, like had some hits, that blues, right? But they've been like transcendent, like the Stones without Jagger. Probably not.
All that is on such a razor's edge, right? I mean, your fame or your obscurity is a razor's edge. And so many people, there may have been 10 people, 10 guitar players just as good as Eddie Van Halen, fall off the obscurity.
Sure.
You don't remember them. Was there an event, though? Was there an event or a show? I know the backyard parties gave them a reputation, but was there an event or a show that really caught the eye of the music industry? I know that you had mentioned Gene Simmons and his interest in them early on. Was there something that really got their attention and said, hey, we need to go down here and make a play for this band?
Well, I mean, you know, honestly, there really wasn't. I mean, I think like, you know, the gig with UFO that happened in May of 1976, that had a big buzz on the local scene, but they didn't get signed because of that. You know, basically the story is that UFO shows up. Those guys are kind of burned out and kind of like, just like, oh, it's just some local band. And Van Halen kind of came on, played all their original songs and blew UFO away because they were basically prime for the show. Had a, you know, it was a big 2,000 people were there at this ballroom in California, but they didn't get signed because of that. You know, really, there really wasn't a, before they were signed, I wouldn't say there was like a single gig. I mean, the Pasadena Civic gigs, which happened on a regular basis before they had a record deal, and then after they had a record deal, were important. You know, but ultimately, the legend, I've talked to Ted Templeman about this multiple times, obviously, and having done the book with him, and then he contributed to Van Halen Rising, was, you know, it was basically, he got a call from Marshall Burrell, who was booking the Whiskey at the time and had been somebody that Ted had known from the 60s on, and he knew he had good musical taste. Marshall said, there's this group I've been kind of helping out. You might want to come check them out. I think you'd like them. Showed up. And, you know, Ted told me straight out, he's like, look, you know, I knew Marshall kind of had good ears. And I, you know, he's like, I got, you know, I most people had called me, I would have been like, well, I'm not going on Monday night to see some local band. But he went, and the rest is history.
And I heard a rumor, and I'm sure it's probably well documented, that Ted Templeman actually wanted, at the time, he wanted to replace Dave with Sammy Hagar even from the start. Is that true?
Yeah. So the story goes that the way Ted would tell the story is that he had real concerns about Dave in the first few weeks that he signed the band. They did a demo for Warner Brothers with Ted, you know, in the studio at Sunset Sound to kind of hear all their songs. And when he heard it back, he just, you know, there was a lot of missed notes. And there was a lot of things that were magnified, as you can imagine, in the studio where there's no showmanship and there's no show. And kind of the stuff kind of really shows up to somebody who was a producer, who was somebody who worked with the Doobie Brothers and a whole host of other groups that have like stellar vocal abilities. He was like, I don't know about this. This is going to be, I don't know. And he was concerned. And Ted talked that he was basically mulling over in his mind, kind of whispering, maybe if it really doesn't work with Dave, I can call Sammy, who was someone he had worked with Montrose. Ted had produced two of the Montrose records with Sammy. Sammy was a solo artist in 77, 76, but, you know, it was never like a master plan where Ted was like, I'm going to do this. It was because the way Ted tells the story, pretty soon after that, a few weeks after that, he starts spending a lot more time in the base. He starts going to Ross Mansion and watching those guys rehearse. They have a record deal with Warner Brothers now, and he's going to produce them. And he starts talking to Dave and watching Dave and listening to Dave and listening about his lyrics and going, because you know what, man, I've got it wrong about this guy. I mean, he may not be the perfect singer, but he's smart. He's got the vibe. He's got, you know, basically all the stuff we've talked about. He's like, there's, you know, it's a lot more than just that. And basically Ted's said to me, he's like, you know, I'm going to coach, you know, I knew I could coach him up. I have someone who was, I can do that. I can help him, and we'll basically, you know, work through whatever challenges there are. And the proof is in the record, how amazing the record is and how Dave, you know, stood out. I mean, that's the thing too, that I think Ted obviously would tell you too, that Dave was identifiable, not always in the best way, I mean, to Ted's ears, but it was unique.
Yes.
It was unique. And that's the key.
Again, he had his own sound. Absolutely. And it was absolutely identifiable. And all you got to do is just put him on the road forever. I mean, just put him on the road. Put him on the road for 2 years and let him go out there and do his thing. Because, you know, that's where he's shown for sure. Unfortunately, here's my Van Halen origin story. Again, I was 11 or 12 when I first, I mean, I had heard some of those other songs. I didn't really know who it was. But it was 1984 where it really hit home for me that, wow, this is Jump and Panama and I'll Wait and Drop Dead Legs. Just an amazing album, you know. So when they asked me what my favorite album was, it was that. But then I was at my cousin's house that maybe that summer or the summer after, and we're sitting back, and all of a sudden I hear that, whatever that is, reverse car horn sound, whatever that running with the devil sound is, and then that bass car comes in, and I said, "Holy shit, what is that?" And then the guy, he's like, "Well, that's Van Halen." You know, I was like, "That's Van Halen," and then because by that point, when I heard that, Dave was gone. Dave had left the band, and now this new guy came in, and again, I've told this story also, that my mom, being a mom, she realized that I really loved 1984, so she bought me that 5150 when it came out. And I was mad, you know, because, again, you are a Sammy guy or you're a Dave guy.
Right. Who's this new guy?
Who's this new guy? So I didn't listen to the tape for months, for 3 months. I did not listen to the tape.
That's great
story. And so I finally pulled it out and I put it in there, and second song comes on, and you know, Why Can't This Be Love came on. I said, oh, shit, that's so good. You know,
damn it. I didn't want to like this, but it's so good.
I was angry. I'm not going to lie. I was angry that it was so good.
That's funny.
And then I started listening to that whole album. It's like, oh man, this whole album is so good. And so, I mean, it was definitely different, but I could appreciate what Sammy brought to the group. But then unfortunately, I don't know what it is. I don't know if it was really, because when I hear Sammy talk, he seems eminently likable. He seems like the one of the best guys. Michael
100%.
And Michael Anthony actually left, when he left, Michael Anthony kind of left with him and said, okay, I'm going to be with you, not with these guys that I've been with for 20 years. Right. I'm going to stay with you. And so it strikes me, and it's like, what is it with Eddie or with Alex that maybe makes them difficult to work with, or what makes them to the point where they're just now, you know what, I'm kind of done with you, we'll move on.
I mean, I don't even think it's a matter of being difficult or not. I think that's one way to think about it. I would just reframe it to say it's their band.
Yeah.
You know, it's always been their band. And I think that was the thing that eventually ran out of patience, you know, ended their patience with Dave, was that they're the ones who invited Dave to join their band.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I suspect that when Roth's solo career started to take off and there was really a feeling that Dave is using us as a platform, he's basically stepping on our backs to get himself above us. That wasn't going to go with those guys. And the other thing to think about is that they're brothers. I mean, that's the other thing too. Yeah. It's like, you know, they may be difficult, you know, in theory, like just getting air quotes like difficult, but it just may be that, you know, they've got a voting block that makes it difficult when, you know, they may fight it out between themselves, but you know, I'm pretty sure when it came to like band business, there was pretty much a unified front. They decided in private what was going to happen. So, I mean, that could be,
Do you think it was the, Eat 'Em and Smile that really was the end of Dave? I mean, that the fact that he went out and just did a... Because other lead singers and other members of other bands had gone out and done solo projects and still been a part of the band.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think the, the EP, the Ted Templeman four-song EP that was done, I mean, I think there was already a lot of fraying between those guys and Dave. There was making the 1984 album, which I discussed in detail in the Ted Templeman book, was a difficult process. And there was already struggles about thinking about the next record, probably how to go forward. Ted had talked about how he was hoping they were just going to take a break for a while, kind of like take some time away from each other. And the EP came out, and yeah, I mean, I think that was, I don't think that was like the only thing. I think that was just like one of, when piled on top of all the other stuff. I mean, I think it was, but I definitely, again, from my talking to Ted about it and sort of my as an observer, that seemed to be, yes, a particularly irritating thing to the brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, ultimately, the other thing I would say that people should understand is that Ed was the songwriter, and Ed was the one who was coming up. I mean, the main sort of the guy who came up with the song ideas
right.
in most cases. And Dave would finish the songs off, the vocals and the lyrics. That, you know, when you have a lead singer who doesn't really like a lot of the stuff that your guitar player is coming up with, and that was already happening during 1984 sessions, that's a problem too. I mean, I think that was the other thing too, that Dave didn't really like it. And, you know, I think the one example that's great to think about, which has probably slipped through the cracks for some people, that Dreams was supposedly one of the ideas that was pitched to Dave in 1983 for 1984. Again, I'm not saying it was like a finished song, but it's basically like, here's this keyboard thing I came up with. Again, I call it like song idea. And, you know, Dave was like, you know, basically wasn't interested. And of course, Sammy heard that whatever it was and kind of ran with it and did, you know, made one of the iconic Van Halen songs.
There was not, there is not a day in his life that David Lee Roth could sing Dreams.
No, it's just not his, and it's just, no, and it just like, you can't even imagine him like,
no, not even,
trying. Even working with that, right? And working with that song. I mean, then he goes on to do, it's interesting, he goes on and does this whole, you know, he does Just Like Paradise with the Skyscraper, which is like super poppy, super keyboard driven, which is, I always thought was like great.
And then he goes just a gigolo. I mean, how do
there's
you...
like poppies, right. So, you know, but I think that that was, I think personality clashes, musical clashes, and then of course the other stuff, which is just, you know, all the extracurricular stuff, which you can imagine was kind of obviously a contributing factor as well. But
yeah, it's funny that he would complain about the keyboards and shit on the keyboards, but then he's doing Just a Gigolo, which to me, that was a horrible song. But it's just funny because you could definitely see when he did his own album, the difference in his taste versus the Eddie's.
Yeah, and I mean, think the other thing to think about for people is like put on YouTube, look up Eat 'Em and Smile Tour. There's a great bootleg from Detroit, Michigan. There's a couple of others. You can see the Vi Sheehan lineup. Kind of, if you want to know what Dave would have wanted Van Halen to do, that's all you have to do is look at that and go, because that was Dave calling the shots. I mean, obviously that was Dave's, you know, Dave was the definer along with Pete Angelus of that whole tour and that whole, the album, like you mentioned, that's sort of Dave and Ted Templeman. And the
guy. Right.
But, you know, if you can imagine if with Van Halen, if Dave could make the decisions about everything, I mean, that would have been, you know, a different deal. He had the brothers and there was a different a power dynamic there. But yeah, that's like, I would say that's, you know, that's Dave's vision for what he wanted rock to be like in 1986 would have been the Eat 'Em and Smile Tour and the record and stuff. So,
just a couple more questions here, if you don't mind. So,
no, sure.
I gave you my favorite album. My favorite album was 1984. And again, it wasn't because of the quality of the songs, even though I think the songs are fabulous. It was more an emotional thing for me. And I tend to do that a lot. We've also had one where we did our favorite Kiss album. And my favorite Kiss album was Lick It Up. Because again, it was 1983. That was right in my wheelhouse.
Sure. Yeah. So, right there. Yep.
But my buddy Dennis, who also comes and sits in with me occasionally, his was the first Kiss album. His was the Van Halen one. And those were his first, his favorite albums.
He must be older than you.
Only about a year, but the difference is he had an older brother. He had an older brother
brother who turned to mom when he was like four.
Exactly. I found it more organically, right? I found it from the radio because, you know, Lick It Up was on the radio.
Sure.
Jump was on the radio. So what would be your favorite Van Halen album?
Well, you know, my favorite Van Halen record, I always say, is Diver Down. And I say that because to me, when I listen to Diver Down, it sort of reflects the whole diversity of what Van Halen was. Is it the strongest Van Halen record? No, I mean, no, it's not stronger than Van Halen 1. It's not stronger than, you know, we kind of go, not stronger than Fair Warning. There's a Van Halen record, it's not stronger than Fair Warning.
Right.
But to me, I will defend it. I defend it all the time on Twitter to people who come at me with all things, all covers, it sucks.
Yeah, it's all covers. Because, it's a cover album.
Right, it's got a lot of covers. Because the covers are what Van Halen did. Mm-hmm. You know, beyond the whole making of the record, which is a whole different thing, it had to be made very fast, and that's why there were so many covers on it. But that was what defined Van Halen's career for a long time. We're doing these covers. And along with that, I think there's these brilliant little Eddie Van Halen musical interludes. Their father plays on it. It's, to me, kind of crystallizes, in addition, how versatile they were, that they could do big, basically like a big band jazz song and Big Bad Bill, to do space heavy metal and Hang 'Em High, to do a cowboy song. They could do all this whack, the Eddie Van Halen guitar stuff, all this whack. They did a Motown song. So to me, you know, sort of shows like, if you want to showcase the whole gamut of what Van Halen was.
And where have all the good times gone?
I mean, you can show, you know, you can listen to Van Halen. You want to hear like Kick Ass album that like destroyed the world. Listen to Van Halen 1. You want to hear like that was the power, the volume, the energy, all that stuff, is the vocal, like all that stuff. I'm like, that's, but to me, if you want for people to understand what Van Halen's about, I always kind of point the Diver Down, which gets, you know, gets slagged all the time, but that's okay. I always fight people on Twitter about it. It's pretty funny, actually. I like post something. It's like, you know, it's like the second most triggering thing to Van Halen fans. It's like the first one is Sammy Hagar.
Oh my goodness.
The second one is like Diver Down. Like people are like,
Sammy and Dave is like Pepsi or Coke. It's like Democrat, Republican.
I mean, it's weird because it's like, it's not like that for like Ozzy and Dio, really. I mean, maybe it was, but it's like never lasted. It's never, it hasn't lasted. Like it may have been in 1980 or 81. People were like, Ozzy's better, Dio's better. But like, That's
to me, it's like
it's interesting, right?
If John Lennon left the Beatles right after Sgt. Pepper and Elvis joined. Then Elvis is still great. Right. Elvis is great, sure. But he's right. Not John Lennon.
Right.
So
right.
You'd
right.
have to,
right. Right.
Are you John or Elvis? You know, I grudgingly began to like Sammy. We do play, you know, in my band, we play Why Can't This Be Love? I mean, I love Amsterdam, that song. I mean, vocally, some of the things he did were just amazing. I think he's an incredible singer. Incredible singer. I even actually liked one or two of the tunes from Van Halen 3 with Sharon, but I was also a big Extreme fan before that.
Right.
I enjoyed Sharon before that. So I thought he kind of got a bad rap, but it is what it is, I guess. My final question for you tonight, Greg, and I really appreciate you coming in and talking to me for sure.
Sure.
What do you think the enduring legacy of Van Halen, in your opinion, is? I know we talked about, or I mentioned, they spawned an entire decade of music just from what they did in the late 70s. But what will resonate with some young man or some young woman right now who's just kind of sitting there, and maybe they hear that first reverse car horn like I did and say, what the hell is that? What is it about Van Halen that we're still talking 40 years later?
Yeah, I mean, I think number one is the songs. I mean, to me, you really realize the longer you live, at least I have, is that the songs are what matter, that you can hear a song from, you hear Rock Around the Clock from the 50s or something. You still like, it's a great song. You know,
yeah.
It may not be something that people heard or listened to, but it's something that's going to live on forever. So the songs for sure. And there's so many, you know, we could go through the whole laundry list of great Van Halen songs, even if it's just like Running with the Devil, Jump, How for Teacher Panama, Unchained, the songs that people will hear that they recognize. You know, I think Eddie obviously is synonymous with guitar virtuosity, but I think, you know, the thing that goes beyond that is that because he was more than just a guy who did great solos, he was a guy who mastered how to get a sound out of an amp, the guy who knew how to build his own guitars and innovated in those areas.
Mm-hmm, right.
And so now there's the EVH brand. I mean, there are guys in country music who play, Taylor Swift's guitar player, Paul plays EVH gear. You know, go through all these different guys. Brad Paisley can play Van Halen licks, all these guys. So it's, you know, basically the debate between the technical ability, the songwriting ability, all that stuff is going to live on. And of course, as you mentioned too, the whole notion of, you know, David Lee Roth, you know, is a household or was, and, you know, will be a name that people will remember because he was so well defined with what it meant to be a front man. So, you know, 75 years from now, if there's like someone teaching a college class on the history of rock music, they're going to be like, and there was something called a front man. And people are going to be like, what does that mean? And they're going to have like Freddie Mercury, Dave, Robert Plant, and somebody else. I don't know, someone else up there. You know, it's like, it's going to be like, it's defining that category of the person who could control an arena audience, knew how to perform for the person in the last worst seat, but as well as the person in the front row, and had that that unusual ability to project themselves in big spaces like that and sing. You know, that stuff's going to go on. But for me, I mean, you know, without a doubt, the songs and then the pairing of Dave and Eddie, those two things together.
There aren't a whole lot of bands that I can think of where two of the players I would put on a Mount Rushmore of that position.
Right.
I would put Dave on a Mount Rushmore of frontmen, like you just mentioned. You mentioned three. It's hard to come up with that fourth, but I think those first three you said are pretty cut and dry. Eddie is the Washington on the Washington Monument. I mean, he is right there in the front. His whole half of his body is there.
I think the thing is, it's like it's almost, you know, 50 years from now, I hope Eddie lives for another 50 years. 50 years from now, he'll probably be passed on. And I think, you know, it's almost like it becomes this thing where as the more perspective goes on, it's sort of like, oh, you know, this guy was like Fred Astaire or something like that. People like, you know, recognize.
Yeah.
I don't know what it was like at the end of Fred Astaire's career where people like, yeah, Fred Astaire, whatever. Yeah, he could dance, whatever. But like people like kind of look and go, it's Fred Astaire. Like he was something special. You know, and I think that's the thing about Eddie is like, it's going to be a legacy that's going to live on well beyond his own life on this earth. And it's just the whole set of skill set that he brought to the game is just unbelievable. And
yeah, my only regret is, unfortunately, I kind of feel like they just kind of petered out to me and they just kind of went away. And I really wish they could have. You know, not everybody can end like the Beatles ended, where they just went, boom, here it is.
Right.
We're going to drop, you know, Let It Be on You, and we're out. see ya.
Sure.
You know, that's unfortunate because I think I really wish that they could have found a way to really just boom and pop
right.
and
put a fine
and gone out on not necessarily on top, but
sure.
Just, rather
well,
than,
yeah.
That's it. That's me being. Believe me, if I was those guys and I could still pull in 50,000 people in an arena, I would do it until I was 110. I really would.
Right.
So, you know, I'm kind of talking out of both sides of my face there.
No, I understand. I mean, I get it. I mean, I think I'll play both sides. I mean, I think as a Van Halen fan, I probably, anyone listening to this would say, I wish they had made 5 more albums.
Yes.
You know, like more albums with Sammy, whatever, more albums.
Yes.
You know, last 20 years, I wish they'd put out 4 more albums.
Exactly.
And the flip side of it, I think probably people rationally can understand, like, they had a streak that lasted from 1978 to 1995 with platinum records.
Right.
They, you know, broke all these, you know, broke all like the Billboard, like, you know, active rock chart, whatever it was, the chart, the most hits on the chart, you know, you kind of go down the list and it's like, they did it. They played the biggest stadiums. They had the biggest paycheck at the US Festival. They made it with, you know, they made albums with 3 different singers.
Yeah.
Brought back Sammy. They brought back Dave. They toured. Eddie played with his son. And his son is launching his own career now. So, I mean, I suspect that's the flip side of it. It's just that, you know, I could imagine. I don't know what their motivation is, but I could imagine them going, I've already played arenas.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, I'd rather do whatever. Whatever I'd rather do. You know, again, I'm just imagining, like, maybe Eddie's like, I'd rather design guitars. I'd rather work on putting out guitars and putting, you know, I'm not 20 anymore. I don't have unlimited energy. I'm going to focus on putting out a new Shark guitar. That's because that's cool and that's fun for me, rather than going on tour.
No doubt. I guess that the only issue I have is that it kind of seemed like it imploded once Sam left
sure.
the first time. You know,
sure.
when he left and then they started with Sharon, I think that was really just kind of the end. And, you know, they brought back Dave for a minute. And I guess he's been with them now for actually a while singing the stuff. But there's really nothing new coming back. And that was kind of the end of the really good new stuff was when Sam was gone. It's just sad to me. But it is what it is. I mean, I think the rock stars are aging out. And we don't really see sure. them anymore. To me, those are kind of the last vestiges of maybe them and, I don't know, Def Leppard. I guess I love Def Leppard sure. too. But that whole idea of the rock star is aging. And that's really, for men of my age, that's incredibly sad. I wish we had more
age.
Rock and roll. Yeah.
Men of our age. I'm not as young as I wish I.
Yeah, I just wish we had more rock and roll. You know, we've gotten away from it, and maybe it'll come back at some point. But that's why we keep hanging on to. You know, we play Panama. We play Why Can't This Be Love, and those are the hugest songs we play, and they're 40 years old. And that's a statement there, I think. But once again, thanks so much, Greg, for joining me tonight.
Hey, it was a pleasure. I'm glad we did this.
Would you like to spend another moment? I don't know if you have anything else that you're working on currently you'd like to promote for a second or anything else going on?
Well, I'm kind of in a holding pattern right now because of the homeschool. Wow. I'm operating out of.
Yeah.
But, you know, I have other book ideas and there'll be another book that'll come out eventually, but I have nothing. I think like everybody else, their life has been probably disrupted to one degree or another by what's been happening with the pandemic. And so, But I appreciate certainly the support. People can connect with me on Twitter at Greg Renoff. The Ted Templeman book's out. It's on Amazon, Audible, Kindle, all those good things. I have signed copies. People can hit me up for those. I'm happy to sign books.
Oh,
and I'm hoping next year when the pandemic lifts, the plan was originally to do is a book signing with at least one, maybe multiple book signings with Ted on the West Coast. And that got scrapped, obviously, by the pandemic. So hopefully that'll materialize and that'll happen. And I appreciate everybody who's reading the books, and it just it's a real pleasure, and I'm just appreciative of everybody because it's a cool thing for me, and love talking Van Halen. It's great I get to do this.
And once again, that's VanHalenRising.com is the website, and you can purchase the book on Amazon.com as well, right?
Sure, the books are on Amazon. Yep,
absolutely. That sounds great, and I would love to talk to you about Ted Templeman at some point too in the future if you ever have more time. That'd be great.
I'm around.
So thank you very much, Greg. And I appreciate it. We'll talk to you again soon.
Pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. So once again, Greg Renoff, Van Halen Rising. Man, I could talk Van Halen. I could talk music in general forever. I could talk about it for hours and hours and hours. I just love music. We've had several music episodes over the course of the Prove Me Wrong podcast. And this is another one. We've had two now on Van Halen. Van Halen Rising, the early years of Van Halen. Yeah, I mean, I agree. I do. I absolutely think that if you had individual Mount Rushmores for bass, guitar, lead guitar, drums, and vocalist. Van Halen has at least two members on Mount Rushmore. I am maybe Freddie Mercury is up there, but I have never seen anybody like David Lee Roth in his prime. I really haven't. His shtick has kind of gotten a little old now, and it's a little bit more buffoonish now, but I don't think anybody can deny the power that he had at that point in early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. He was the sexiest man alive, the baddest man alive. Most young men I knew would have paid money, done, you know, cut off an arm, whatever, to be David Lee Roth. I mean, he was it. Every guitar player that I knew was trying to tap it like Eddie Van Halen, trying to play like Eddie. I think he did spawn a whole decade's worth of musicians who were just trying to chase him, just in his rearview mirror, trying to find something that makes them display real talent. And it's unfortunate that when we got into the 90s, you know, musical taste changed, and it is what it is, but we lost the solo. We went a whole decade without doing guitar solos, really. Power chords and synthesizers, things like that, but you lost the guitar solo. And that was what made the late 70s, or, you know, the whole decade of the 80s so amazing, were these maestros, these virtuosos on an instrument just going crazy. It was so incredible. And as a young man, hell, I'd pick up a little tennis racket and I was acting like I was playing the guitar like that. I would have loved to play the guitar like that. It absolutely takes an enormous amount of dedication and just innate skill to be able to get your brain to work that way. I don't think that Van Halen will ever come again. It is unfortunate to me, and I am saddened by it. I wasn't lying. I'm sad about the death of the rock star. I think that the rock star is going away. The idea of a rock star is going away as we know it. And maybe it'll come back. I don't know. I think music goes in phases. People might come back and realize that you put a couple of hard chords together and throw a guitar solo in the middle, and that makes people move. I don't know. I love it. But it was very interesting talking to Greg about the early days of Van Halen, how they got together, how they made their name playing in backyards and playing at high school dances. That's all super, super fun to me. It's just so different. You know, ZZ Top did the same kind of thing. They were, you know, playing high school dances and things like that. You see a lot of those bands from that time frame. That's how you got made, playing high school dances. But what do you think? Do you ever go to a concert and see Van Halen? See David Lee Roth? See Sammy Hagar? And that is the question. Are you a Sammy guy or are you a Dave guy? I mean, that was the question when I was in school. Where's your allegiance? And your friendship was either made or crushed based on your answer. It really was. You could tell what kind of person you were. If you said, I'm a Sammy guy, I know what kind of guy you are. We're not going to talk about it, but I know what kind of guy you are. So have you ever seen them in concert? Drop us a line and tell us about it. The email is provemewrongcast@gmail.com. Write us a letter. Tell us what you think about Van Halen. What's your favorite album? Again, for me, it's all emotional. 1984, it's just when I discovered them myself. I didn't have a big brother. I didn't have an older cousin or somebody else showing me that music, that older music first. I kind of found it first, and then I went back. You can also find us on Facebook or Instagram. Prove Me Wrong is the name of the program. Just search for it. You'll find it. If you're just looking for more opportunity to listen to the podcast, you can find us on any podcast app that you like, being Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Spotify, Anchor, really anywhere where you find podcasts, you can find the Prove Me Wrong podcast. Like and subscribe to the show, and you will be notified when a brand new episode is released. We typically release a new episode once a week. So if you like and subscribe to the show, you will be notified when a brand new episode like this one drops. We're also on YouTube and we're on Rumble. So you can find us on YouTube or Rumble and look for the Prove Me Wrong podcast. Once again, like and subscribe to the Prove Me Wrong podcast, and you will be notified when a brand new episode is released. Again, I do release a video version where you're looking at it right now if you are watching the YouTube version. If you're just listening on podcast itself, on the audio, go to YouTube and see. You can actually see Greg and watch our conversation. Either way, it's totally up to you. But like and subscribe, and you will be notified when a new episode is released. Before we go tonight, the Prove Me Wrong podcast has been brought to you by Zendo Zone Citronella Burners from JT Eaton. There's my version of Zendo Zones right there. They're shaped like fearless bug repellent tiki gods, if you can see. Tiki god. So let Surf and Stan, Hawaiian Howie, and Luau Lily bring the islands to your backyard with Zendo Zone Citronella Burners. Zendo Zones uses natural 3% citronella candles and incense cones. They're perfect for patios, decks, backyards, campsites, poolside, and more. You can enjoy the outdoors again. You can find them on Amazon.com and at select Ace Hardware stores, so go ahead and collect them all today. So for my guest tonight, Greg Renoff, Van Halen Rising was the name of the book. I am Pete Lieb. This is the Prove Me Wrong Podcast. We'll talk to you again soon.